This tape contains the conclusion of Aldous Huxley's speech on human potentialities and is then followed by the interview with Aldous Huxley on NET TV program Kaleidoscope.
Well, finally now, we come to the last section of this talk, which is the problem of how do we actualize our potentialities for more love, for less fear, aggression, and hate. Well, this is a very interesting problem. What seems to me abundantly clear, unfortunately, is that no amount of preaching or exhortation is going to make many people much better than they are. That telling people that it's on the whole better to love than to hate is not going to make them any more loving. And that stoical repression of these things is also not going to do much good, because this thing, if you can repress your external violences, the violence is likely to turn back upon yourself and to produce all kinds of psychological and psychosomatic disturbances within the organism. Therefore, what is the solution? Here again, we're up against the same problems I mentioned before, that it's extremely easy to enunciate ideals, extremely difficult to find the means whereby they can be implemented. Well, in this context, I think we must not be reluctant to turn back and see how earlier peoples and even primitive peoples solved these problems. We mustn't be ashamed to learn from them. And of course, we can learn a great deal from very highly civilized people, such as the ancient Greeks. And we see that the Greeks had a number of extremely effective devices for dealing with this problem of aggression and hate and frustration and fear. They did both things. Of course, Plato and Aristotle preached to them a great deal, but I often think that the effect of their preaching was probably a great deal less than the beneficent effect of such things as corybantic dancing and the Dionysian orgies. I mean, I think if one had to ask who did more good to keep the Greeks sane, Plato and Aristotle on the one hand, or the corybants and the maenads and the maenadism and the Dionysiac orgies on the other, I think this second would win hands down. Because what it did was to provide people with a safety valve for getting rid of these destructive emotions in a physically violent and yet harmless way, and also a way which was integrated into the religious life of the time, so that it had a great philosophic meaning. The corybantic dances were sacred to the Great Mother, and the orgies were sacred to Dionysus, and both of these fitted into the theology of the Greeks. Dionysus in those circumstances was called Lucios, the liberator. And the corybantic dancing was used not merely to get rid of these kind of violent feelings, it was also used as a mode of diagnosis and a way of finding out what was wrong mentally with people. And apparently it was just as successful as Freudism, and probably a good deal more, because Freudism, after all, insists that you spend all your time on the couch and never use your muscles. Well, after all, we do exist as muscles and as viscera. And this the Greeks understood perfectly well. And many people, much more primitive than the Greeks, of course, have discovered these ways of letting loose, of giving vent to these violent emotions in harmless fashions. I was greatly struck 4 years ago when I was in Brazil and was taken to see in Rio and again in Bahia the what are called the candomblé dances in Bahia and the macumba dances in Rio. And this is very, very interesting, because here you go into these appalling Negro slums of Rio and of Bahia, where people are living in indescribably wretched conditions, where There's an enormously high rate of unemployment and general frustration of life. And here on Saturday nights, you will see great numbers of groups performing these dances and going dancing the whole night through without any aid of alcohol, which always surprised me very much, and getting rid of all the frustrations of the week in this way. And it was most interesting to see the actual motions. For example, the women, when they danced, kept throwing their head, that the hair would fall forward, and they would throw it back. And one reads descriptions of the Maenads doing exactly the same things in Greece. It was, made me understand the Greeks extremely well when I saw these unfortunate people dancing their way out of this, of their aggression and their frustration. And as I say, we must not be ashamed to take hints for these people. These people are no stupider than we are. We happen to know a lot of things which they don't know, but there are many things which they know about how to manage their lives, which perhaps we don't know. And it, I think there's a great deal to be learned in this, in these fields, from the older civilizations and even from contemporary, quotes, primitive civilizations. And then another quite extraordinary device invented by an amazingly primitive people was described by Margaret Mead in one of her books about New Guinea, where she speaks of the Alpesh, this small tribe, excessively primitive, but who've invented a way of applying Pavlovian principles, not for brainwashing, as this has been done in modern times, but simply for increasing charity and compassion. This is done with the very small children. The infant is brought into contact with other members of the family and other members of the tribe, and then also into contact with the domestic animals, with the dogs and the pigs and so forth. And his skin is rubbed against them, and as this is done, the mother keeps repeating in a sort of gentle voice the word which means good. The child, of course, doesn't understand the word at that age, but he understands the tone of voice. And when he comes to learn to speak, he has the memory of this buried in his mind. And the result, apparently, is that there is a real sense of solidarity within the tribe and a solidarity with the other members of the natural order, with animals. Well, it is most extraordinary when one comes to think of it that all the great world religions have exhorted us to love our neighbors and that charity and compassion are supremely important. But it has remained for an incredibly primitive tribe on a remote tropical island to devise an extremely ingenious method, fully authorized by advanced Pavlovian views of physiology and psychology, for implementing this. And here again, we mustn't be reluctant to take hints from these other people. Well, I think I've said enough now. I mean, to point out that there are enormous potentialities, both for good and for evil, latent in human beings, and that it is probably perfectly possible for us, if we set to work intelligently, to elicit many more of these potentialities in more people, many more of the desirable potentialities in more people than have been elicited up till now. And after all, these three desirable potentialities for more intelligence, more creativity, and more love represent the solution of all our problems. We have to combine them all. Intelligence without love and creativity is apt to be inhuman, and love without intelligence is apt to be impotent. And we must combine the two. We must make the best of both worlds, and we must, while proposing high ideals, consider all the means whereby, some of which may seem rather childish and silly, but nevertheless they work. Consider all the means whereby these ideals can be implemented and the categorical imperatives connected with the ideals can, in fact, be obeyed. Thank you.
The following interview with Mr. Aldous Huxley, one of the series of Kaleidoscope programs, was rerun on Chicago's WTTW, Sunday, July 21st, 1963, at 5:30 p.m.
Huxley has said of himself that if this were the age of heraldry, his motto and crest would bear the legend, Aun aprendo, I am still learning. Described as an engagingly brilliant young skeptic in the 1920s, he has in the years since established himself as a controversial yet dominant force in the world of letters. Aldous Leonard Huxley was born in Surrey, England, the grandson of the eminent biologist T.H. Huxley and the grandnephew of the celebrated poet and critic Matthew Arnold. His education at Eton was interrupted when an affliction of his eyes left him almost totally blind. He surmounted this difficulty and finished at Oxford in English literature and philology. Most of the 1920s were spent in Italy, where he first began to produce a prodigious outpouring of novels, plays, poetry, and essays that were to establish him as one of the foremost writers of our time. He moved to America in 1937 and now makes his home in Los Angeles. He is currently a visiting professor at the University of California in Berkeley, where we would hope he is reaping the critical and material rewards of his latest novel, Island. Mr. Huxley, in your very famous novel of 30 years ago, Brave New World, you drew us a picture of what I suppose was the inevitable consequence of living the kinds of lives that we lead today. And then more recently in Island, you showed us how things could be but really are not. What, in your estimation, is the final end of man? For what purpose does he live here on Earth?
Well, that's, of course, a good question. I mean, this basic question is, what are human beings for? Popular at the moment, there seem to be two views on either side of the Iron Curtain. Unfortunately, on this side, there seems to be an opinion that man is for consumption. On the other side, the opinion seems to be that individuals are for supporting the almighty state, and that they're even for cannon fodder, or for industry fodder, or for road-building fodder, as in China. But I would think that the answer to this question is that they are here in order to be helped to actualize the greatest possible number of their desirable potentialities. It's quite clear we have immense potentialities which are still unactualized, and a society, it seems to me, can be judged on a good society is one which helps individuals to actualize their desirable potentialities. A bad one is one which prevents them from actualizing their desirable potentialities, or may, like the Nazi society, actually help them to actualize the most undesirable potentialities.
What are some of these desirable potentialities actualized?
Well, I would think that you can categorize them under three main heads. The intelligence, friendliness, and creativity. I mean, these seem to be the three main heads of desirable potentiality. How are we to become more intelligent on every level, on the level not merely of concepts and symbols, but on the level of immediate experience of perception and imagination, how are we to become more friendly and less hostile and aggressive towards our neighbors? And how are we to become more creative? And this seems to me the whole problem of individual and social psychology.
I want to pursue this further with you, but I'd like to turn back, if I may, to your own experience, and particularly in your early years. You have become a moral critic. You have expressed in a great wealth of essays, novels and short stories, your own convictions. What was the source of these convictions in the early years? You grew up in a family, your father was an essayist, your grandfather a biologist, your brother a distinguished scientist, not, of course, when you were young. What was the atmosphere of the family in which you grew up in Surrey, England?
Well, ours was, I suppose, a sort of what might be called a cultivated upper middle class family. My father at that time was a teacher in one of the English public schools at Charterhouse. My mother, when I was about six, founded a girls' school of her own, and when I was about six, I mean, this school was started, and my father then moved out of teaching into the realm of publishing and editing the Cornhill magazine, which was the magazine which Thackeray founded in the 19th century. And this was the atmosphere in which we were brought up. I don't think it was anything very special about it. It was,
were you urged to learn, encouraged to learn?
Well, we were certainly encouraged to learn, and on the whole, I think my schools were good. I went to the ordinary sort of upper middle class schools. We went first to a preparatory school, a boarding school, from the age of about 9 to about 13. And then after that to Eton. Eton at that time was still, it was a very curious school, because its main teaching was still along the lines of sort of Renaissance humanism. We, for example, we spent the whole of every Tuesday translating a piece of English poetry into Latin verse. We started at 7 in the morning and weren't finished till we went to bed at 10 that night, which I must say, looking back, seems a rather odd way to spend the whole of one day of each week. But then also it was extremely modern, as being one of the very few schools at that time in which one could, after 15 and a half or 16, specialize in biology. They had an excellent biology department. And I had begun specializing there with a view of becoming a doctor when this thing happened to my eyes. I got this attack of keratitis and I had to leave school.
Why had you chosen to become a doctor?
Well, I had an uncle who was a successful and good doctor, and I think I should have made a very bad doctor. I might have made a reasonably good research doctor, but I don't think I would have been a very good bedside doctor. And perhaps Providence moved in very appositely to cut short this career, and because afterwards, of course, I couldn't go on with a biological training because I couldn't use a microscope.
You've said that the most important single event in your life was unquestionably the onset of your eye trouble. You said that it had the effect of isolating you during the years of your adolescence and forcing you to live largely upon your own
well,
inner
indeed.
Resources.
I mean, naturally, one has to make the best of handicaps, the best one can, and this undoubtedly was a very serious handicap, but it did have its compensating advantages. I mean, it certainly turned me in on my own resources, made me think more than I would have done otherwise. It probably also preserved me from being killed during the First World War. Practically all my friends were killed. I mean, they all became second lieutenants, and about 75% of them never came back.
What caused you to turn to writing then?
Well, I began writing when I was half blind. I actually wrote a complete novel, which I never was able to read. I learned to type without touch typing. And I wrote this novel, but then I think I lost the manuscript before I was able to look at it again. But this was when I began writing, and I was always extremely interested in
it. You've never seen that novel then?
No.
The world?
It vanished long ago, and I don't know. This was when I began. Then I used to write verses when I was an undergraduate. My first two small books of verse.
Was it at all curious that you should jump from science, and particularly medicine, to verse and to essays?
Well, I suppose this was in the family. After all, my grandfather was not only an eminent zoologist, he was an extremely good writer. I mean, I think he was one of the, I don't want to crack up the family, but he was undoubtedly one of the best popularizers of science who's ever written. I mean, his essays are still marvelously readable. And the actual textbooks, I recommend you, if you want to read a piece of really good technical exposition, to read his book on the crayfish. I mean, you really can reconstruct a crayfish from his prose, which is and anybody who's tried to describe in detail a complex living organism knows how extraordinarily difficult it is to render in words the complexities of a natural object. And he did have this gift, and he had I think he had a remarkable gift of writing in general on philosophical and scientific subjects. So that it was in the family.
Mr. Huxley, you said that you turned upon your own inner resources during those years of late adolescence and in your early 20s. What external forces were shaping your convictions? What persons most influenced these convictions?
Well, during the time that I, after I left school, I had various tutors because I couldn't be at school. I had to learn Braille for my reading, and then I had one or two tutors, and two of them influenced me very much. One who was killed during the First World War, and another who is now an eminent historian, Sir George Clark, who is the provost of Oriel College in Oxford until he retired. He tutored me for 6 months, and I learned a great deal from him. And then I was able to go on. I was able to do my reading with a powerful magnifying glass, and I went to Oxford and came under the influence of some very able men there.
And in the early years in Italy, when you first began writing, when you were associated with John Middleton Murray, D.H. Lawrence, and others, I presume there was a common interest that brought
persons together. Well, I worked, before going to Italy, from 1919 to 21 or so, I was doing literary journalism in London. I worked on
the Athenaeum, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I had to supplement my income in various other ways. I worked for the Condé Nast publications, Vogue and House and Garden, and then also the defunct Vanity Fair, which Frank Crowninshield was then editing. I was very fond of Frank Crowninshield. So I did dramatic criticism and literary criticism in other newspapers, and even musical criticism, God help me. It was all very good practice. And then when I was able to, my first wife and I and a small boy moved to Italy, and there I could devote myself mainly to writing novels and essays.
Were you largely alone as you wrote, or was there a good deal of activity and associations with others at this time?
No, we lived a fairly social life. We lived in Florence during the spring and autumn and went to the seaside in the summer. We had very good Italian friends and a number of English friends living there too. So that I was never really alone then.
Let me turn, if I may, Mr. Huxley, to one of your most famous novels, Brave New World. The world which you depicted for us in that novel was a world that was, I suppose, 600 years hence, was it not?
Yes.
And then in your preface to the later edition, you said you had cause to revise the estimate of the date at which we might arrive at this brave new world.
Well, this was actually the first motivation for Brave New World was a reaction to a very over-optimistic utopia of H.G. Wells's Men Like Gods, which annoyed me, and I actually began with the idea of writing a parody of this, but then the whole subject of what may be called a negative utopia interested me so much that I settled down just thinking out what would be the nature of a society, a dictatorial society run on scientific lines. How would you dominate a society in such a way that you would persuade people to love their servitude? I mean, and this was the problem which I tried to work out. Now, since then, of course, we've witnessed the most rise and fall of two of the most frightful dictatorships. I mean, the dictatorship of Hitler and the dictatorship of Stalin. And of course, it was in response to those dictatorships that Orwell wrote his book 1984. This was written in 47, 48, as I remember. And this was a projection into the future of the immediate past of those years, the past of Hitler and the still present dictatorship of Stalin. I greatly admire 1984. I think it's a very remarkable book. But my own feeling is that the scientific dictatorships of the future will probably resemble Brave New World more than they resemble 1984, yes. Not for humanitarian reasons, but because manipulation of the mind and the physiology is probably more efficient as a way to dominate a society than firing squads and clubs and concentration camps. So that I remember writing to Orwell shortly before he died, telling him how much I admired the book, but saying that I did think that his was not the more likely outcome. I mean, and I think that there are certain factors in modern life which seem to be pushing us towards a kind of centralized totalitarian control. And as I say, if we're not very careful, we shall find ourselves there. Nothing is inevitable, but we have to use a great deal of intelligence and goodwill, I think, in order to avoid this.
Yes. I should like to ask you what some of these factors are, but I feel quite certain that I know what one of them is. Mm. We are embarked now upon what is known as the age of space, which I suspect you might refer to as the age of not enough space because of overpopulation. You have said in several of your books that overpopulation is almost an inevitable road to tyranny.
It seems to me, because as numbers press more and more heavily upon resources, you get an increasing sense of frustration, and you may get an actual decline in the standard of living, which indeed, according to the figures published by the Food and Agriculture Organization, has happened already in various parts of the world, that the standard of living is actually falling. And, of course, what is going to happen in regard to the population explosion? Nobody has the faintest idea. I was in India last autumn, and I must say one comes back extremely depressed. I mean, the latest census returns show that the Indian population is increasing not, as was supposed, at the same rate as the United States, which is 1.7% per annum, but at 2.3, and a population increasing at 2.3% per annum doubles its numbers in 32 years. So that by the 1990s, India will have 900,000 people living in it. Well, how they're going to solve this problem, I haven't any idea at all. And nor, when I talk to political figures in India, I don't think anybody has any idea in India of how they're going to deal with this.
I suppose the usual thought is technology, that some way, somehow, science will find an answer. But you have argued that technology also leads inevitably to tyranny.
Well, I think, as I say, nothing is inevitable, but there is a tendency, naturally, because as every advance in technology requires a corresponding advance in organization. And this is almost always some kind of centralized organization, so that the individual tends more and more to find himself merely as a cog in some vast machine-like organization. As I say, unless we really think out how democratic principles are to be applied within the entirely new context created by explosive population increases and very rapidly advancing technology, unless we do work out such means, I think we are going to be pushed in this direction. I don't see any, we have any hope. But I mean, it does require a lot more intelligence, a lot more goodwill on the part of all concerned, and a lot more foresight or preparedness to think in further into the future than we're prepared to do now than people have done in the past. I mean,
why have we not thought more carefully about the future, Mr. Apley?
Do we ever think carefully about the future? I mean, I was up in the northern part of the state the other day, in the region of Mount Shasta, and talking to a forester there, and he was talking about one of the local towns, which they'd had a meeting some years ago of the Chamber of Commerce to discuss the problem of whether they should go on cutting all the trees in their area, liquidating it as they call it, or else get on to a permanent yield basis, which would mean a slightly lower immediate income. And the Chamber of Commerce voted to let the future look after itself and go on cutting to the limit. Well, now the future is here, and the whole economic situation is going down the drain. But I mean, this seems to me characteristic of human beings, that it's very difficult to get people to sacrifice an immediate good for what is obviously a more distant good. I mean, this is the whole problem of democracy. I mean, can you democratically organize a world government, which is obviously necessary, can you get people to vote for a state of affairs which, though it's obviously good in the future, may cause a good deal of discomfort in the present and will certainly interfere with a lot of vested interests? And the answer, I'm afraid, is no. I mean, Toynbee has said this, that it's these great comings together of states into vast empires have always been carried out by conquest. Well, this is very undesirable, but the alternative is getting people to vote for it. Well, are they going to vote? I don't know, but it doesn't look as if they were.
Democratic states have cooperated in the face of an imminent crisis.
This is the point. I mean, if there were, people have said there were an invasion from Mars, then we should cooperate. But of course, in a certain sense, we are our own Martians, and that by increasing at 2.3% per annum, as we're doing now, we are putting on the equivalent of a Martian invasion of this world. And are people going to realize that we are in the teeth of a Martian invasion, which we ourselves are bringing about?
It would seem that the crisis is almost upon us, judging by a prediction which you made in 1957, when you said it's a pretty safe bet that 20 years from now, all the world's overpopulated and underdeveloped countries will be under some form of totalitarian rule. Now, that's in the immediate future.
Well,
since that forecast
was made, how many of the newly independent states are now military dictatorships? I think about 12 have already turned that way. And it wouldn't surprise me in the least if at Nehru's death or retirement, the Indian army took over, just as it's taken over in Pakistan. I mean, in all these countries, there are two well-organized forces, A, the Communist Party, B, the army. And in most of these countries, the army is better organized and a good deal more powerful than the Communist Party. So I think they will be military dictatorships rather than communist dictatorships. Well, you may get a good, excellent general, but I mean, a military dictatorship is obviously undesirable in principle. But I think in practice, this is what is going to happen over a great area of the world.
People who are democratically inclined would certainly recognize this future as one they didn't want. Mm. And when you picture it this way, I'm sure their reaction would be, something must be done. But you've said that the change comes about almost without our awareness.
Well, it seems to me the first thing is for people to become aware. I mean, for example, in relation to population, there was a profound reluctance until I think I'm right in saying the autumn of 1958, for anybody to look at this problem. I mean, popular regard of the problem. I remember in 57, I was in New York with a doctor friend of mine who happens to be interested in the population problem, and we tried to get some foundation or one of the big TV networks to sponsor a film on this subject. We could not get anybody to take any interest. And in fact, the head of one of the smaller foundations, who I happen to know, told me, you won't find anybody who'll do this because the subject is controversial. And the foundations are afraid that if they do this, they will get questions asked in Congress about their tax-free situation. 1 year later, in the 1 month, both the big networks, Time, Life, and one of the other big magazines came out with, it was as though the dam had broken. They all came out with long TV shows or with articles on the subject. But this shows how recent this thing has now come out into the open, and today you can hardly open a newspaper without finding some reference to it. But this doesn't mean that we come anywhere near solving the problem. I mean, but the first thing is to become aware, and you can't do anything until you have become aware. Mm-hmm. But what exactly we do next is another question.
Social awareness begins, I assume, from individual awareness. And you have had much to say on this. In your most recent book, Island, and I hope I'm not distorting the meaning here, one of the elements is the minor bird, which shouts constantly, attention, attention, to draw oneself to an awareness of oneself. Mm. You have said that your life has been a struggle to free yourself from, I suppose, the tyranny of egotism, to free yourself for an awareness, for experience. What do you mean by this?
I would say that awareness is one of the absolute goods. I mean, this has been, from earliest times, one of the great religious and philosophical commandments. I mean, this was what Socrates learned from the oracle, know thyself. And you will find this again and again within all the great world religions, the necessity of being more aware. And it seems to me that this is an absolute good, and that any training in awareness is essential for going on to do anything else. And I think in general that we have to introduce into education training not merely on the conceptual and analytical and symbolic level, as we're mainly concerned with now, but also training of immediate experience, such as perception, kinesthetic experience, imagination, and so forth. Training in what I call the nonverbal humanities. And all this seems to me an absolutely essential part of improving human individuals, of helping them to realize their desirable potentialities, and of at the same time of creating a society which will help them to do this, a good society. As I say, seems to me absolutely essential.
Mr. Huxley, your book Island was in a sense an antidote to Brave New World. You showed us what could be. Why did you give it an unhappy ending?
Well, because I think if such an island were there, it probably would have an unhappy ending, unfortunately. And also that there are literary reasons, because one has to stop somewhere, and it's easier to stop with a bang than to taper off. I mean, I do think that, as things now stand, there are more people in the world more concerned with creating unhappy endings than with creating happy endings, I'm sorry to say. I mean, I think most of the people who control the destinies of man at this time are not particularly concerned in what I think is the really important task of people, which is, as I say, to help as many people as possible to realize their desirable potentialities.
Mr. Huxley, we hope that it was more literary than conviction, and that perhaps the kind of hopeful things you had to say in Ireland, at least in part, can come to pass. We've been talking with Aldous Huxley. We've talked with Mr. Huxley here on the campus of the University of California, where we've had the assistance of the television crew, for which we are very grateful. Until next week, good night and good viewing.